Yeah, so first of all, I'd like to thank Tom for inviting me to come back to PI. It's been a while since I was last here, 6 years, I think. Still thinking about the same stuff. So the title of my talk is Relative Quantum Time. We will get there eventually, but Tom invited me here to discuss some ideas he's been having about quantum reference frames. And because the relative quantum time business is in some ways has sort of emanated from ideas about quantum reference frames, that's where I'm going to start. So this is a long ongoing project that I had with Paul Bush, who sadly passed away about a year ago, just under a year ago, and Takayuki Miyadera, who's in Kyoto. So of course, this talk has to be dedicated to Paul. We hadn't finished working on many ideas, so it's really a sad loss. Sort of slightly happier situation. There's no good picture of me and Takayuki. There's one main reason for that, is that some of us don't do well in photos, but this one came out quite well. So we had a cappuccino in a cafe in Tokyo, and to our surprise, they delivered a pretty good likeness in coffee art of us working together, which was a pleasant surprise. So there's the only existing photo of me with Takayuki. Okay, so let's get on with the physics. Please do stop me at any point if something I say doesn't make sense. I have this strange habit of somehow omitting the one crucial thing that will tie the main ideas together. So stop me if that happens. So general quantum mechanics. You all kind of know how this works. We have some Hilbert space, which may be of infinitely many dimensions. It'll be complex in general. We have states, which live in the trace class of that Hilbert space. We have some set of possible outcomes of measurements. For technical reasons, one would have omega as a sort of outcome set, and then one would have some sigma algebra of subsets that are measurable in the right sense. So that would be when one has infinitely many outcomes or continuum of outcomes or something. It's not crucial for this talk, but just to make sure I'm being precise. Observables, we take the general point of view as being positive operator valued measures on this sigma algebra that take values in the bounded operators on the Hilbert space. And the operational, the empirical content of the theory is described by the map from some potential measurement outcome to this Born rule expression, where we have just the product of the states with the POVM element, if you want to call it that. And that would be the standard setting. And then one may have something extra, one may have some symmetry group, which is manifested as some automorphism of this algebra. So we would have a group that acts in our Hilbert space and has an action also on the observables. So this is what we're talking about. This all works extremely well. The predictions are good. So what are we worrying about? Well, the question that I would like to ask or begin my talk with is, what is observable in quantum mechanics if one has some fundamental symmetry constraint? So the symmetry may be a space-time symmetry, it may be a gauge symmetry. But the question we wanted to ask is, well, how do we modify? Does any of this need to change if we have some fundamental symmetry? So the first guess, I think, which would be reasonable, is to say, well, the things that are observable in this theory are the things which are invariant under the action of the symmetry group. I think that's a reasonable guess, and I think it's a correct guess, but one has to be a little bit more specific about what one means. So if one just takes this point of view, that the invariants are the only observables, if one takes the standard description that I've just given, it looks like there's almost nothing observable left in the theory at all. Yes?
One question, like, if you say observer, like, I'm thinking of observer, like, if you have the problem of observer in quantum mechanics, I'm at a specific point in space-time, so I'm breaking the symmetry for the observation I make. Like, what do you mean by observations?
So I will get to that, but at the moment I'm saying this is how people do quantum mechanics. Okay, so we have a system described by a Hilbert space, and we have a symmetry action on this Hilbert space. So that's the setup. So I will get to the point of different observers and so on. But at the moment, I'm just saying This is how people go about their business normally. And if one does this, then one doesn't have a lot left that can be observed in general. For example, there are no coherent states, because that would be incompatible with phase shift invariance. There are sort of very few superpositions in a slightly vague sense. We'll come back to that. There would be no localized particles in this theory, because that would break shift invariance. There would be no time evolution, because that would break time translation invariance. So there's almost nothing that one can say. So this is, I think, a conundrum. How does one reconcile the extraordinary effectiveness of the normal quantum framework with the fact that we do live in a world that has symmetry, and that symmetry does impose constraints on what's measurable? So let's look to the classical situation and see if we can come up with some idea about what's going on. So classically, of course, symmetry, I say relativity, I mean the sort of relationalism or the relativeness of quantities, and the existence or necessity of reference frames in your description are all intimately related to each other. So we know that positions, angles, times, velocities, and so on are truly relative or relational quantities. And one has to take this into account. So in classical physics, one has the Galilei group, that's the symmetry group of Newtonian space-time. And these quantities, positions, angles, and so on, are truly invariant quantities once you realize that one has to specify a reference frame in which one discusses these things. So I think it's a sort of deep question about whether positions and angles and things are relative because the Galilei group is the fundamental symmetry group, or the Galilei group is the fundamental symmetry group because positions, angles, and so on are relative. I think that's an interesting question. But the point is that relative position is shift invariant, relative angle is rotation invariant, relative time is time shift invariant, and so on. So this invariance manifests when one takes into account the fact that there's a reference frame dependence in one's description of these standard physical quantities. And a sort of remarkable thing about classical physics, I think, is that somehow the absolute description, i.e. without reference frames, or the relative description in which the reference frame is explicit, are sort of completely equivalent in a way that is so sort of fundamental that we don't even really notice that one has to make a choice about whether one describes things or should be explicit about whether one is including the reference frame explicitly or somehow ignoring it. We don't have to really make that choice in just standard classical Newtonian physics. But it turns out that in quantum mechanics, we really do. So yeah, classically, your reference frame would be an inertial frame. You have a coordinate system, which can be abstract, just some mathematical object. Or you could have some suitable classical particle or some system of classical particles that behave as a reference frame. And it doesn't matter whether one views the reference frame as physical or as mathematical or abstract. Everything is sort of fully equivalent. It doesn't matter. One has a sort of freedom in how one discusses reference frames. So my point of view is that the reason that mathematical reference frames, classically abstract reference frames, work is because of the way that classical systems behave. So we'll come back to that at some point. And I think the crucial thing is that classical particles are localized with respect to all variables simultaneously. So a classical state is well localized with respect to position, momentum, time, etc. And I think this is the remarkable difference. And maybe I can convince you at least partially of this. So let's have a look at the quantum case. So quantum mechanics, so I'm always slightly nervous talking when Rob's in the audience, because much of our work on reference frames was inspired by your big review paper. So I hope you'll agree with at least most of what I'm going to say. So quantum mechanics is drawn up with respect to some implicit classical inverted commas, because it's not exactly obvious what that means, but one can have some intuition about what one means by that, some implicit classical reference frame. So, you know, we all do undergraduate quantum mechanics where we have the position operator. It's just some self-adjoint operator in L2, acts by multiplication, but we all know that the position is really a relative position, but there's some background classical reference frame that we're referring to. Same too for angle, so one can formulate self-adjoint angle operators on the circle, which are also just multiplication by the angle here. And another case is phase observable as a positive operator valued measure, which is, I'm going to focus a bit on that. So the question is, well, if one really believes that the reference frames are in the first instance to be understood as physical systems, then the position operator, should be a relative position operator where the reference frame, the system to which the second part of the observable to which this Q is to be relative should be a quantum observable. It should be pairs of quantum systems that we're talking about. So one can have a variety of views about the universality of quantum mechanics, but if one takes that perspective, then I think one can argue coherently that reference frames should be understood as quantum physical systems. So the question is, well, how do we define quantum reference frames? How do we deal with them? And then how do we understand, the important question is, how do we understand the relationship between the situation in which we have an explicit reference frame and in which we don't? So we're sort of motivated by classical physics, and we're asking how the situation looks in quantum mechanics. So what is the relationship between the absolute and the relative description? Can they be made to agree? Do they agree in general, or is there some condition that has to be satisfied, and so on? So one place to look is phase. So I use this example because it goes back to this optical coherence controversy that has been essentially settled, but it's a nice motivating example. So in quantum mechanics, we can have these number observables. They generate unitary groups, and one can construct phase as an observer, as a genuinely quantum observable that's characterized simply by its covariance under phase shifts. Okay, so this was one of the breakthroughs, or one of the important observations of using POVMs in quantum mechanics to represent observables, is that phase has a proper description here. So it's covariant. So you have the action of these unitary operators, and it just acts by shifting by the value of theta. An addition is understood modulo 2 pi. So if one takes the point of view that I started with, that what is observable is invariant, and we just look at the level of some quantum system, then invariant observables, well, they have to commute with the number. Right? So I'm talking about phase shift invariants here. And this means that some state and its completely decohered version can't be observationally distinguished. So Pn here are just the projections onto the eigenstates of Ns. Okay. So we just take this map, I call it tau S star. That's for a sort of technical reason that isn't super important in this talk. But it means that there's no invariant quantity that can tell the difference between rho and its sort of decohered version. Okay, so this means that coherent states and incoherent states can't be told apart by any observational technique. So this was a famous issue in quantum optics, I suppose, where Molnar wrote a paper saying that quantum coherence in a quite general sense, or at least in an optical coherence sense, was a fiction, a convenient fiction. So there is no such thing as coherence. The state produced by a laser is not a coherent state. So this is a radical point of view. We all like to believe that coherence is a real thing in the world. So, as Rob with Terry and Steve Bartlett pointed out, is that, well, coherence is itself a relative notion. So I think the way that we draw things up is slightly different from the way that you do it, but hopefully there's some similarities. So the idea here is that we redefine what coherent means. So we take some system and some reference, we tensor them together, and okay, so Yeah, so this is the phase case. So I'm going to talk about the general case, and then I'm going to come back to quantum coherence after that, optical coherence. So what we want to do is, instead of just thinking about the system on its own, introduce a reference frame, a reference system, and do everything at the level of system plus reference together. So the whole idea, or this is the sort of central object of this perspective, is that one can relativize any absolute quantity. So suppose we have, at the level of our quantum system, some self-adjoint operator, Hermitian operator, A, and we want to understand what A is as a relative object. So A is, it could be the position, it could be the angle, it could be the phase, it could be any arbitrary observable, that's the point. So we have some unitary representation of our group G, and we can integrate it, and this gives us an operator on HS, tensor HR, so the tensor product. And here what we have is some covariant P of M. So the Yen map is our version of the dollar map, slightly different, but inspired by the dollar map. A little bit more general because we have an arbitrary P of M here rather than, I think you have G, do you know what I mean? So you have G back to back, G, DG as in your dollar. And this is just.
Is it covariant?
It's covariant, yeah. But it's not projection value necessarily.
We had like a unitary acting on that.
Anyway, it's. So the point is that one can feed in anything and get out some invariant quantity. And the invariance manifests because of the covariance of this thing. So if we're talking about G is just the real line, one can throw in the position operator and it spits out a relative position operator. But the good thing about Yen is that it works in all cases. So there's some technical things I've written down here because you never know who's going to be in the audience. So if there are any sort of operator algebra enthusiasts, the next 3 points, 2 points are for you. So this Yen is a nice map. It's unital, which means that it takes the identity to the identity. It preserves the adjoint. It's normal as a map between von Neumann algebras. It's completely positive. Normality is important because it means it has a unique predual. And then, I mean, this one's for the sort of serious enthusiasts. This has some deep connection, which I haven't understood yet, with something called cross products of operator algebras by group actions. So this is, I don't know if there's anybody here who likes C-star algebras and von Neumann algebras, but Yen in this case is actually just the natural inclusion of A into the cross product. So I think there's work to be done in sort of finding a level of generality for these things that makes things look simpler by using more sophisticated machinery, and this is the direction that one would go. So what does Yen do? Exactly this. So it relativizes positions, it relativizes angles, it relativizes phases. It's pretty general. It's not completely general. It doesn't work for... So it took a vast amount of effort to actually construct this integral, and it still doesn't obviously work for arbitrary topological groups. But if one doesn't worry about that too much, it does a lot of stuff. So the question is, okay, so we can put in any observable here, and Yen spits out some relativized quantity, some invariant quantity. So that's what's genuinely observable in our theory. So then the motivating question of a lot of this work is, well, what's the relationship between A, so this is the sort of illegal absolute description, and the sort of true relative description, which is Yen of A.
Are there any constraints on like the reference system? Does it have to be like as big as the system, or can it be like?
It can be anything.
Okay.
Because I haven't said whether it works yet or not.
Yeah, could have just had a trivial like.
Yeah, so it could be. So it'll still be invariant. All you need is a covariant quantity here. But we'll see shortly that actually. So it's not in this talk, but yes, it can't be. To get good agreement between A and Yen of A, you can't just have anything. So that's relativization in a nutshell. And what we want to be able to do is also restrict. So we can take arbitrary quantities of the system S, give relative quantities of S plus R. But what we want to be able to do is say, well, given some reference state, what do things look like if we forget the reference state again? So if we look back at just the system on its own, contingent on some state of the reference system, what do we see? So it's not just a partial trace, but it's related to the partial trace. So we fix some state, rho r of the reference frame, reference system, and define this restriction map here that takes us from system plus reference just to system, and its definition, well, there are multiple definitions that are equivalent, but this is the simplest one, is that it just takes a trace against the second part and spits out the first part as it was. And then you extend by linearity and continuity. So this is, again, for operator algebra people, this is a conditional expectation in the sense of von Neumann algebras. But I think this is the right way of moving from system plus reference description to system description contingent on some state rho r of the reference. I guess one could argue about this, but yeah, I think this is right. And now we can kind of compare like with like, because we're comparing two operators on the same Hilbert space now. So we first relativize A, and then we restrict it back again, and we can ask whether the restricted relativized A is or is not close to A. So this is an absolutely disgusting looking slide. I can only apologize. It doesn't matter too much. There's some technical details. So what one finds is that one can, in a limiting sense, make the absolute and the relative descriptions agree entirely. But one needs a technical condition for this reference system. It's called the norm one condition, and it's a localizability condition. So this is satisfied by all projection valued measures. It's satisfied by positive operator valued measures that satisfy the so-called norm one property, which means that you can localize sequences of states in arbitrarily small sets, provided that this effect is not the zero effect. So if this sort of POVM language is not your cup of tea, just think about projection valued measures, self-adjoint operators, and it won't really harm you too much. It's a localizability condition. It means that we can squeeze states really, really on arbitrarily small intervals. And that is the absolutely crucial thing for getting agreement between A and the restricted Yen of A. In fact, so it's not in this talk, but one does get a lower bound on the difference if one does not have good localizability. So that's in a different paper. Yep. This is technical. But what we want to do is choose some very small set. It should contain the origin of the group. And then we can make some sequence that sort of gets squeezed and squeezed and squeezed and squeezed until it's a bit like a delta at the origin of the group. And then one gets exact agreement between, in the limit between the relativized and restricted A and A. So a classic example, sorry, is there a question?
What is X?
X is, I should have said. So X is some measurable set in our group. So think about the real line. It would be some subset of R that's measurable. So if G were R or S1 or something, then it would be some measurable subset of R or S1. So think about, just think about it as an interval around the origin of the group.
Okay, I see. So you need this property to hold for all X?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And now you're choosing one of those that contain the original.
Okay, so the canonical phase, this is one of, so there's a whole family of phase observables in quantum mechanics. The canonical phase is sort of the one that behaves most like what one would think of as a phase. This satisfies this norm one condition, and one can take the limit across a set of high amplitude coherent states. So the interesting thing about this limit across high amplitude coherent states is that's exactly the situation where one gets localization around the zero of phase. So I think that hadn't been pointed out before. to my knowledge, anyway. So that would be an example, and we'll come back to that in a second. And the only other thing I want to say about this is that one can take the other extreme. So here what we're doing is localizing with respect to our relativizing observable. One can completely delocalize also with respect to the relativizing observable, and then ask what the situation is. So if you remember this tau map, this was the sort of decoherence map. So what one finds, if one takes a reference state that's completely, that's an invariant state, so it's not localized, it's completely delocalized, and asks what the state description at the level of the system on its own actually is, one gets an invariant description at the level of the system too. So what this is really saying is, well, states are relative, and if you have a reference state that is completely delocalized with respect to your symmetry, then the situation, the description at the level of the system alone is also completely delocalized. So it sort of takes one to know one. If you have no good localization at the level of the reference frame, then you can never see it at the level of the system. And this, of course, is just the twirling map. So the twirling map is sometimes motivated by saying that sort of two experimenters don't share phase information, so they have to average over all phases in order to talk to each other. That's one point of view, but I think this is also an interesting point of view of the sort of origin of the twirling map, that somehow it comes from delocalized reference states. So for example, if our reference state was an eigenstate of number, then the description at the level of the system is the twirled description. That's a sort of quantum, in a way, I think a very quantum origin of the twirling map, because it sort of arises from the uncertainty relation. Okay, so how are we doing? Is there a clock in there? Okay, good. So the story so far is that observables are invariant quantities, but one should sort of make sure that when one talks about invariance, one's talking about pairs of systems, not individual systems. And absolute quantities of S represent relative quantities of S plus R. And this all works out very well mathematically. So good approximation comes with good localization, i.e. the zero of phase or the zero of position, etc. And if one has this good localization, one can just forget about the reference frame and just work in the absolute regime, no problem. So this sort of, I think, answers why we can use this ordinary quantum framework that I gave at the beginning in calculations without any problem. It's saying that, well, actually, what the ordinary quantum framework is telling us about is not quantum objects in themselves, but the relation between quantum systems and suitably classical other systems. I think that's the message of this perspective. However, there is a sort of suspicious circularity that one has to face. And this is that in order to speak of absolute quantities or coherent states of S as representing their invariant counterparts of S plus R, that's system plus reference, we need absolute quantities and localized states for R. Okay, so this is, at least that's how it looks from what I've given. So we have this this covariant POVM, and we need localized states with respect to this covariant POVM. So it seems somehow sort of illegal to believe in the existence of those when we've gone to great effort to try to say that the ones at the level of S don't exist. So what one has to do is deal with this. And this reminds me a little bit, so there was a big debate about the meaning of super selection rules between famous people, Whiteman and Wigner and Vick on one hand, and Aharonov and Susskind on the other. And this sort of smells of that Vick, Whiteman and Wigner pointed out a sort of circularity in the Aharonov-Susskind point of view. And I think the resolution is that one has to have a completely relational picture where one speaks only of the combined system in isolation, and one does not allow at all absolute quantities or coherent states for one system or the other system. So coherence and localization and these kinds of things should be understood as truly relational notions relating to properties of pairs of systems, like more like entanglement. So when people talk about coherence, it's always it's normally a single system that they're talking about. But it looks like you need coherence in one system to see it in another. So there's a new idea that one should define a quantity called mutual coherence. So this is a technical definition. But what the idea is that you have some invariant quantity, E, and you want to be able to tell whether the sort of invariantized state and the non-invariantized state can be told apart. Okay. So I'm going to skip through this a little bit because I want to get to the time stuff. But what one finds here is that some state is coherent relative to some other state, if and only if that state is coherent relative to the first state, so it really is truly relational. And one can generalize this also to entangled states. And this is true also for localization. So I think one can make this completely relational in a meaningful way. So finally on this topic, one can provide some kind of subtly different resolution to this so-called optical coherence controversy about whether laser beams are truly coherent. And the answer is, in a way, yes, but you have to talk about pairs of lasers. Okay. So I'm not going to go through this in much detail. The point is that one can do everything using only invariant states and invariant quantities. One can do measurements of phase observables in Homodyne detection schemes, but one needs a high amplitude coherent state for a sort of reference laser. And what you need actually is a mutually coherent pair. That's the only way that these statistics can actually represent what you see. And the relational coherence, this is another theorem that I'm not going to prove, but the relational or mutual coherence looks like absolute coherence, again, in the same limit that we've discussed so far. So that is that. So hopefully that's helpful for our discussions. So now I'm on to the second part, which is, so if we go back all the way to the beginning, we noted that under symmetry, or under the hypothesis that all observables are symmetry invariant, one would not really have dynamics. Hello. I'll just have a little drink. So there's a question here about how to reconcile the fact that, well, if one believes it, that the universe is somehow translation invariant. I mean, this is well motivated by cosmological questions about the timelessness of general relativity and so on. But we do appear to perceive change in the world. So the idea here is to use this reference frame's perspective to sort of make precise and be able to see how it's consistent to have global invariance but local change. That's the idea. So dynamics is a relative thing. So there's two related questions. One is how to reconcile the time translation invariance of a big system with time evolution of some of its subsystems, because we do see Schrödinger evolution. And the other question is how to understand the T in the Schrödinger equation, which is a sort of classical parameter, again, whatever classical really means in this case, but it's sort of somehow external. So the idea is that we want to bring T into the quantum description fully, the time, and see how it sort of re-emerges in some appropriate way. So this question, both of these questions really, although the first one was phrased slightly differently and was inspired also by the superselection rule question. But Page and Wooters in 1983 showed some people say, showed that one could have a timeless description of the universe and still yet have dynamics for subsystems using this mechanism of conditional probabilities. So the idea is you have some subsystem that which functions as a clock, so it has some dynamical variable that one can sort of use as a clock, and then you condition on the values of this clock system, and then other systems evolve in line with the Schrödinger equation. So this already smells slightly circular as well, because, well, if you have a clock that evolves according to the Schrödinger equation, what's the... yeah, you're done. So the idea of this work is to try to sort of systematize some of these ideas about conditional probabilities and show that it does make sense. So the Paige Wouters argument has been criticized on a number of grounds from a number of directions over a number of years. I'm not going to rehearse all the criticisms of the Paige Wouters mechanism now, but I'm going to propose what I think is a sound alternative, hopefully not subject to all of the criticisms that were felt by the Paige Wouters prescription. So a brief tour of time in quantum mechanics. So there's a famous theorem of Pauli, or at least motivated by Pauli, inspired by Pauli, that there's in general no self-adjoint time observable in quantum mechanics. This is a direct consequence of the semi-boundedness of most physical Hamiltonians. So any Hamiltonian that's bounded from below can't admit a conjugate time observable that's self-adjoint. But it was realized that if one accepts the point of view that observables are properly understood as positive operator valued measures, then one can have a perfectly adequate description of time as covariant objects. So one would call an absolute time observable a covariant quantity. So H is some Hamiltonian, and it's sort of shift covariant. That's the idea. So what we want to do is consider some, we'll call it a clock. It just has to be some quantum system. We'll call the second system a reference. It's just another quantum system. They each have a Hamiltonian, HC and HR, and these each generate some unitary group that's going to be the dynamics. And then I think the new idea here, or at least one of them, is that one should define, in a sense, axiomatically, what one means by a relative time observable. So what we want is some POVM acting on the clock plus reference together that is invariant under time translation. So that makes sense. So
it's quite hard to see the laser pointer.
Ah, yes. Okay. I'm in Canada after all. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I need one in each hand.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So anyway, so what was I saying? So we have some POVM Z, which is invariant under time translation. And then the crucial thing is that it's covariant under these restrictions. So we have our old friend, this restriction map, the gamma rho, that gives us the description just at the level of the system on its own. And what we want is that for any state, for any reference state, we have covariance. So one might ask whether this even exists, such a thing, and the answer is yes, many of them exist. And that is established by our good old friend, the relativization map, the Yen map.
Can you go, sorry.
Yep. Do you want me to go back?
If you go back, do you have a concrete example of this E of X, this kind of POVM?
Yes. So I can, there are many examples. So one can construct a self-adjoint one, for example, if one considers a free-falling particle. It would just be the momentum, I guess. The momentum. So that would be
a free particle.
A free-falling particle in a gravitational field. Yeah, exactly. That would be a sort of slightly unphysical example. But yes, there are many. Well, so. Here's an example. Not yet. So let me think, what would be another good example? Yeah, not one that I could explicitly write down, but there are known to exist families. I can find one.
Really, falling particle is a weird, it's not abounded below.
Yeah, so that would be a, yeah. So that's a sort of counterexample to the Pauli theorem, yeah. But, So one with a semi-bounded Hamiltonian, what would one have? So you could have if you had a harmonic oscillator, essentially, then one would get something sort of phase-like for the time would. The time observable would basically be an unsharp phase observable.
Would it get washed out after one period of the oscillator?
What the probability distribution you mean?
Whatever.
Well, I mean, this is just a POVM, so.
But I mean, would it? I'm confused. Wouldn't it anything evolve periodically? Your system is a harmonic oscillator, did you say?
I was just trying to think of an example. Off the top of my head. Do you mind if I come back to it?
Sure.
Okay.
One question. So
yep.
These V operators, are they just time translation?
Yes. Yep.
Are they what?
Time translation.
Yeah, exactly. So these are just the unitaries. This is just e to the I e to the I h t or minus.
And here t is like how are you interpreting this?
Yep, so that is a problem, yep. which we have not solved. So, yeah, it looks like one is smuggling in something here. I think it's not as bad as it looks, but so far I have no interpretation of this T. I'm not saying that it's time. I'm saying that it's something which when I exponentiate against the Hamiltonian gives me a unitary group, and I can abstractly define these two things. So I'm not saying it's time, because I'm not saying that this should behave in any way like we expect time to behave, really. I'm just saying, I mean, the problem is that in order to talk about invariance, you want to say, well, invariance under what? And then you say, well, invariance under time shifts. You say, well, what are time shifts if you're saying that the universe is timeless? So you see what I mean? Like, one can get in an awful mess. So I haven't solved that
problem. Yeah, it makes sense that you have to do something like this. But then, like, if you have, say, various clocks with different Hamiltonians,
yeah,
then it's how, like, the question is, like, do you use the same T for them, or do they mm-hmm. use their own Ts?
Yeah, I mean, that is also a criticism of the original Page Wouters, which here it's the same, but one could ask about that. Yeah. I mean, I'm just taking the point of view that we have some continuous parameter, T, and that's it.
But it somehow acts kind of together, like on all systems that are kind of acting on by the same T. There's like this kind of universal parameter.
Yeah, so in general, one, I mean, what I'm really trying to say is that one has a representation of the Galilei group or something like this under which we demand invariance. So a T would be a part of that. But you're right, in general, I don't know what the, yeah.
You might, I'm not sure what your motivation is, but one quantum gravity is one possible
mm-hmm.
motivation where you have a nominal T, which is shift in coordinate time.
Yeah.
But you have, in some views, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which says that that's zero. So it looks formally as if you had a Schrodinger equation, but then you restricted yourself to the subspace of time-independent
mm-hmm.
wave function.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think that I would agree with that, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that in a way was the motivating idea. Right, so where are we? Right, so we have these these relative time observables. Okay, and they exist. Okay, and that's established by this map. And they exist also in the, so this is an invariant quantity. ER of t is an absolute time observable, a time p of em. ER of t, dt. So one can show that this is an invariant quantity and is covariant under restrictions for arbitrary reference states. And one can do this also in a discrete setting. So that simplifies things quite a lot. So that's the example I'm going to go through. And then almost all of the conclusions go through, bless you, also in the continuous case. But I'm just going to look for discrete, sharp periodic time observables in some finite dimensional Hilbert space. That's the idea. So these are given by just, we have some orthonormal basis labeled by n, which runs from 0 to d minus 1, and we're acting in CD. And I'm just defining two self-adjoint operators in the clock system and the reference system in spectral form, just given by this sum. So one difference between this time point of view and the general reference frames point of view is that for some reason we require three systems now, which is not completely obvious to me why that's the case, but it's what seems to be what we need. So what we have is three systems. So we have the system S, the clock C, and the reference R. And then we have some arbitrary POVM of the system, or just a self-adjoint operator if you want. That would be a special case. And a Hamiltonian, which is additive across the three systems. So there's no interactions. It's just an additive Hamiltonian. And then we have a sort of momentum-like quantity for the second and third system, which take this form. So in spectral form, they're just this. And these basis states are just the sort of Fourier transform things. Okay. So nothing too mysterious. And these give rise to sort of actions like this. And also for R, I've left off the third one, but it's exactly the same as for C. So that's the setup, discrete periodic time observables. And then what we can do is we can use this Yen gadget in the discrete setting to relativize again. So this gives us an invariant time translation invariant quantity for the whole system. Okay, and I've just included an identity trivially on the first system. So we're relativizing the time here. So this gives us a relative time observable. We can also relativize our arbitrary quantity A in exactly the same way. And this gives us this equation here. So we're relativizing two different quantities, but with respect to the same time-like thing. So the idea, which is inspired entirely by the Page-Wooters proposal, is to seek conditional probabilities. But if one wants to have a conditional probability, one has to have a joint probability. And to have a joint probability in quantum mechanics, you have to have joint observables, jointly measurable quantities. So the cool thing about, or the useful thing about Yen is that we've now constructed a pair, a jointly measurable pair. So a commuting pair, if you like. These two things commute with each other, which means that we can produce a joint probability distribution. Moreover, our Yen acting on this quantity, Yen preserves self-adjointness and it preserves projection valuedness. So this gives us projection valued observable. And if you have two observables that commute with each other as unsharp quantities, but one of them is sharp, it means they have a unique joint observable. And that's good, so it means we can just write it down, and that's this M. Okay? So this is a joint observable for these two relativized quantities. So there it is. And then we can take a product state. So one can choose what state one wants to consider, and we choose this one. Just here. And then we take expectation values in this state with respect to this joint observable, and one just gets this formula 7. So we have a joint probability distribution, and we're looking for a conditional probability distribution, so we just better make sure that the thing that we marginalize over is non-zero. So we can take the marginal, we're just summing out the k's, and that has a particular form. We assume them all to be non-zero, because otherwise you can't find conditional probabilities. And if one accepts, well, if one makes that restriction, then one can write down the conditional probabilities. And the conditional probability is exactly in line with Heisenberg dynamics for the system on its own. Okay, so this is a toy model. It's a very simple situation. But what we had was a relative time observable, and which is the invariance, and then we just look for conditional probabilities, and one does indeed find that the subsystem quantity evolves in line with, well, what the Heisenberg equation would be for this discrete quantity. So I think that's good news. So the observations that I think are interesting are, well, A is completely arbitrary, could be a P over M. This condition that these probabilities, these quantities here are all non-zero, means that the reference state that you start with, this psi, has to be broadly spread out in time. Okay, so it has to be time delocalized. I think that's surprising. And a new observation.
You mean the parameter little t? Or what do you mean?
Yeah, with respect to the little t, yeah. So, yeah. So localized with respect to energy. Yeah.
It's a state of which system, sorry?
This is the reference system, so the third system, yeah. Yeah.
That sounds like the opposite of being localized in N. Localized in N, which means it should be localized in time.
No, it should be delocalized in N, yes. And N is like the energy.
Therefore localized in time.
Oh, hang on, no, N is the time, sorry. I've got
N comes with times
this, yeah.
Right?
Sorry, yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. So did I call it N? Yes. Where are we? Yep.
N is the term.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we want delocalization in time, or, yeah. So that could be provided by an energy eigenstate, for example. And that's just how it works out. Yeah, so choosing this reference state as an eigenstate of the reference Hamiltonian is the simplest way to do this. So I'm still not actually completely sure what to make of that. It seems like maybe what the equations are saying is that sort of somehow change is identified relative to something that doesn't change, or something like this. I'm not sure exactly. It's the sort of if you want to say that a clock hand has moved relative to the face of the clock, you don't want the face of the clock to be also moving around, maybe. I'm not sure. And another interesting observation, I think, is that the state we chose, this psi, is not an entangled state, it's a product state. So there's a lot of recent work saying that this sort of quantum time is due to entanglement. Well, in this point of view, it's not. So one does not need an entangled state to do this. It's a product state. And then it's a theorem, which I'm not going to write down, and I'm certainly not going to prove, but there is an entangled state that has exactly the same distribution, that's genuinely entangled. So I'm sort of curious about what to make of that as well. So yeah, what I'm reporting on now is sort of unfinished business. So it seems like entanglement is not required, which is curious. It's particularly curious because a lot of people say that even based on the Page-Wouters paper, entanglement, quantum correlations are what produce this effect. But if one looks at the Page-Wooters model, it's also not entangled, the state. So the role of entanglement, I think, is not clear. So we have a continuous time model that's in many ways the same. It's much more technical and difficult to do the computations. It shows a similar behavior, except that what is much more explicit is that we need good localization in time for the clock. So that wasn't totally obvious in the discrete model, but in the continuous model it is. But we still need reference delocalization. So the conclusion, which is good timing, is that dynamics can emerge out of this sort of time invariant. One can have a globally time invariant situation, yet have somehow systems changing relative to other systems. It's not easy to visualize that in my, well, for my minute brain, it's not easy to understand exactly what that could kind of look like. If anybody can tell me, that would be good. And that's it, I think. Yeah. So if there are any questions, I'd welcome them. Otherwise, thank you very much for listening. Yes.
So you say the state psi is unentangled, but yeah. Is it the case that the observables you define, they're entangled observables over the partition of the three systems?
It doesn't look like it. So I'm not sure if Yen is an entangling map. I don't think so. If one goes back, it doesn't, I think it's not known if it's entangling or not.
But what does it mean? I don't understand the question. You mean as the observable product of operators, one for each subsystem?
Yeah.
Well, it's not that, but that doesn't necessarily, I mean, that's not necessarily entangled, right? Even if it's a sum of products. I mean, what exactly do you mean by entangled observables?
For instance, if you're measuring in the Bell basis or something like that.
Right. I mean, this doesn't look, I mean, this is certainly not a product, but I don't know if it's entangled. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, it looks like a limit of things that are on it. Yeah. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I still don't understand. What does it mean? You're talking about the observable being entangled. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So every observable can be written as a sum of products. So I don't. And there's no positivity condition here, is there? Otherwise, I don't see what the distinction is between the unentangled and entangled observable.
Well, I'm thinking, I mean, whether it can be written as a convex sum.
Convex sum of what? But if there's no positivity in the separate observables, I don't think that's a very meaningful. Every sum is a convex sum.
These terms is very well, but a product of positive object.
It is product of positive.
Yeah.
Yep.
What is that?
Yeah.
So I think it's a related question, but if I understood, you have no interaction between the clock,
No.
The subsystem, and your third system, the reference system.
Yeah.
But that's very different from anything that people have. I mean, I should probably say I'm not greatly in sympathy with trying to get time out this way. I think time is part of nature, space-time. But a lot of people have thought along these lines, and in the case of quantum cosmology, for example. Mm-hmm. And the clock, often they choose a clock as a scale, they introduce a scalar field and want to use this value of the scalar field as the clock type. But that's strongly, I mean, it evolves with respect to the geometry that it's in. So, I mean, there's a coupled system, scalar field and gravitational field or metric, space-time. So they're very much interacting. It seems strange here that you have no interaction. And what kind of clock would it be in a physical world that doesn't interact with a space-time metric?
So I don't know the answer in that context. I mean, so this is essentially some sort of subpart of Galilei invariant quantum mechanics. That's all we are doing, really. So in the more complicated scenario, I just
don't. Even there, the clock is not. Oh, I see. So you have a background time, the Galilean.
Yeah. In a way, yeah.
But are you trying to recover that time? Is there any connection between?
So what we're trying.
The thing evolves according to the Galilean.
Yeah. So we say that we have some systems. That when one considers them as a whole is time translation invariant. So to say that it's time translation invariant, one needs to say something about what time is before that. Yeah.
But when you say you recover the Schrödinger equation, that looks as if it was the Schrödinger equation for the subsystem.
Yes.
Galilean space.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It makes me ask one other question, which is, it all hinges on your choice of this I don't know what you call it.
The yen.
I missed the definition of the yen, but okay. It hinges on the definition of this joint observable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
This pair of joint observables.
Yeah.
But is there any notion of observation associated? I mean, is one supposed to make measurements out of them? And then the question will arise, in what order, if you make measurements and use a reduction of the wave packet or something, in what order normally the order of the reductions is temporal order, but here time has no meaning. So I'm sort of do you need that or is it missing?
So we just look at the probabilities. There's no reference here to collapse. So where would be the right? So here is the. Yeah. So this is sort of as operational as one could be. I don't know what would happen if one. Tried to explicitly incorporate measurement into this description. I'm not sure. Yeah, we haven't done it. This is just at the level of.
Now, what would it operationally mean to check the probability distribution?
Well, I mean. This is the joint observable. So I'm not sure I completely understand the question.
I don't know how to ask it another way. But, when you say operational, normally one has in mind some observables, POVMs or whatever, and measurements that one can make.
Well, I mean, we have
many copies of this. I don't know. I mean, I just don't see the framework. I'm just asking. What is the?
Well, I mean, this is our observable.
So we have many times, many references, many copies of the whole setup.
That would be the normal. That would be a reasonable way to do it. Yeah, one has identically prepared systems with identical Hamiltonians, and one can check the probability distributions. I mean, this is not the universe. This is some collection of subsystems that happens to be time translation invariant. So I think it's reasonable to say one could prepare.
So the application to quantum cosmology is still unclear.
Yes. So I mean, part of the point of this was to try to see how this would work in the simplest possible scenario, and then try to build it up again, rather than start with the, what seems to be a difficult scenario and get confused with lots of complicated interrelated difficulties. So this is just just quantum mechanics, just Galilei-invariant quantum mechanics for whichever systems you want to discuss.
So there's a quote from Wheeler, time is nature's way to keep everything from happening at once. But here, everything happens all the time because it's localized in time. So what is it that keeps everything from happening at once in this picture?
What do you mean by everything's?
Well, at least the appearance of everything. Things don't appear to all happen at once. What is it that's playing that role?
Well, I mean, it's that some things change relative to other things. And kind of that's all there is. I mean, there is no.
To me, it seems like here it happens like when you have this joint state. And if you do these measurements and you have this transition from the quantum state of the clock to the classical outcome of the clock, and it's where like the things that are kind of delocalized in time localized by virtue of this clock, taking some certain value.
I'm not sure how this I don't see the exact connection between Wheeler's comment and this, what I've said, I'm afraid.
Just that if the things are delocalized in time, then, I mean, the reason for his quote is that things happen at a particular time. Mm-hmm. So two things happen at different times, not happening at once.
Yeah.
But here, things are delocalized in time, so.
But it's only one state that has to be delocalized in time for the mechanism to work. It's just this reference state that has to be time delocalized. So it doesn't prohibit things happening in order for subsystems. It's just that somehow one needs an eigenstate of the energy for the reference system, I think. Yes.
The stuff that came earlier, so you're again a refresher, I don't know what dollar math was.
So we had it.
Dollar map instead of your POVM, we did have a projector, we just wrote a projector onto G, so the set of those projectors were basically assumed to be tab inner products, which gave us delta function, G and G product.
Yeah.
They're infinite dimensional systems and perfect representation of the group in the sense that any small fraction of the group takes into an orthogonal element. And the reason we did that was we wanted to show that the algebra of operators, so we wanted a map that you could apply to states and POVM elements and Kraus operators and so on, in such a way that not only sums were preserved but products as well. Cover the whole algebra, so whatever your algebra of operators are, originally, so you get like trace, row, sum map, acting on a POVM.
You get all those probabilities back again when you map everything through this dollar map. So it's like every state, every measurement, every transformation has a counterpart in the invariant stuff. Now, when you drop that property of this delta function,
you're not going to preserve the algebra. It's kind of like the Yenmat degrades things.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if there's a connection with it. After we wrote the review paper, Steve and Terry and I wrote other papers on bounded size quantum reference frames, and you try to encode, for example, a quantum state into these symmetric states, but where your reference frame was not infinite dimensional, so it didn't have this delta function property, how much could you get it out again? And so I feel like what you're doing is very much in that same spirit.
I agree, yeah.
So there's probably a connection between your Yen map and that later work. But one place where I feel like we really were making different choices is in a couple of slides from now, you talk about the recovery, this recovery map where you choose a state on the reference and then you trace over that to get back a state on the system. And that, you admit it was like, well, it's a bit awkward to have a state which now is non-invariant under the action of the group.
Yeah.
We were supposed to be, understanding things in this invariant way.
Yeah.
So there, I feel like you have not availed yourself of one of the conceptual insights of that whole literature on quantum reference frames, which is, I think it's one of the sort of most interesting things that came out. So here's the example that if I'm talking about the position of a ball relative to something that I'm not going to treat dynamically, like a wall.
Yeah.
So, Newtonian mechanics, bounce the ball off the wall, I have some coordinate for the ball. But then if I choose to treat the wall as a dynamical system, I have an X wall and an X ball in my new treatment where the wall is dynamical. The way I get back my old coordinate of the ball is not by marginalizing over the coordinate of the wall, it's by taking the difference. I say, the old thing I used to call the coordinate of the ball when the wall was treated externally is the difference between the coordinate of the ball and the coordinate of the wall. So it's kind of, it's a relational degree of freedom. And it's the same thing in quantum mechanics. If I have like the hydrogen atom, position of electron and proton, and then I switch to center of mass and relative.
Yeah.
If I treat it, originally usually when we do textbook quantum mechanics, the position of the electron is just in some external potential, that the proton is not a dynamical degree of freedom. And I would say, if I do choose to treat the proton as a dynamical degree of freedom, what was the textbook degree of freedom we were talking about? It was the relation, it was the difference in those positions, not the position of the electron itself. And so that's why here, I would say, what you need to do is not trace over the reference frame. You need to find where the relational degrees of freedom live between the reference frame and the system, trace over the global, and leave only the relational.
I feel that this does do, so I did think about this example a lot, the ball against the wall. And.
Because you can do that, like this example, like Terry, I mean, and Steve and I have given examples with phase and rotation where you find the relational degrees of freedom, you trace over the other degrees of freedom. And then you don't need any rho r that breaks the symmetry. You just find, you recover your original A in those relational degrees of freedom.
Yeah, so I think we definitely do it a different way, but one does also get that here. So for us, I think the relational part is in the form of the observables that we fix. Invariant observables as being the only allowed quantities. So if it's the ball against the wall, we only allow relative position to be observable.
But in your prescription, if I had to say, how do I recover the position of the ball relative to some non-dynamical treatment where the wall degree of freedom, you'd say, ignore the wall degree of freedom and just look at the ball degree of freedom. That's what tracing over the reference is. It's marginalizing for that. It's not take the difference. Here you couldn't just take a difference, but it would be like, roughly speaking, taking a difference. Like if I have an X tensor I as the position of the system, and I tensor X is the position of the reference frame, the right way to get out the original position of the system is I tensor X minus X tensor I, not trace over one of those systems. Do you agree that's different?
I think I need to think about exactly what you're saying, but I'm not just tracing out the second system. That's not exactly what this conditional expectation does, I think. So what this map does is it takes, the idea is that we take some invariant quantity, and then we say, well, what happens if we, what is the right way to understand how to get back a description in which that, yes, so the wall system is just implicit rather than explicit. So if one has the ball and the wall, it's a good example. So the wall might be not very heavy, it might be sort of fuzzy or something. Or it might be essentially infinitely heavy. So my feeling is that our localization limit is pretty well the wall is classical and very heavy situation, in which one, then the coordinate of the ball is exactly the same as saying it's the coordinate of the ball relative to the wall, where we just don't need to talk about the wall anymore. Because those are, that's statistically what we see in this localization. Do you see what I mean? So, but if the wall was sort of fuzzy, like quantum mechanically delocalized, then one could not appropriately externalize the wall in the same way.
What would you get if you have like a perfect reference frame? Like this Yen map becomes the Durer map?
Yeah.
And,
yeah, I mean, we have that.
What does this map become? Like,
yeah, then it's.
Interface somehow?
Yeah, well, no, it's, then it is a homomorphism. I mean, if this is projection valued, this is basically just dollar.
And then you go back and you get back A for any state.
No, not for any state. No, you have to have a localized state that's localized at the origin. Yeah.
But when you describe something, you make a transition from the wall external to the wall internal. And
yeah.
Then you say, all right, to get back to wall external, what I'm going to do is take this description where the wall has a diameter internal. I'm going to assign to the wall a state which is highly asymmetric. Because that's what it means to be a good classical wall, a good reference frame. And then I'm going to say, now let's trace over that and see what happens for the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've had to throw in all this asymmetry. You've had to deviate from the desideratum of describing everything as symmetric in order to recover it. And I'm saying you didn't have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You could just say, no, now I look at the relative coordinate, x wall minus x ball, and I see what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have to introduce any arbitrary state for the wall, which I consider classical or anything. Just all of that is unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, I think it's conceptually questionable because it's introducing asymmetry explicitly on the side where everything's supposed to be
mm-hmm.
symmetric. So it's sort of like in the early days of these discussions, you know, often the arguments went that way. That it was, you were always sort of pushing back to, oh, well, if there's something which is asymmetric, then I can explain things. And the arguments always ended up with, well, is that asymmetry there at the initial state of the universe?
Mm.
And eventually we came to the opinion that was a red herring, that you don't need to talk about the state of it. If you just look into the, find a new way of factorizing the Hilbert space that
mm-hmm.
disentangles the global from the relational degrees of freedom. So anyways, that, I think that would serve your purposes better.
Okay. Yeah, so. Yeah, I'd like to think about it more. There are two things I can say. One is I felt like this decomposition didn't work in general, this relational and, what do you call it, global.
It is a difficult problem in representation theory in the generic case.
Yeah.
I agree.
So that
it's not trivial.
Was a...
I still think it's the right way to do it.
Okay.
And so we should just embrace the challenge. Try to do it for those groups where we don't want to do it.
So I think I'd worked it out for, it was in my thesis, so that's how long ago we're talking. But for the number case, so the,
yep.
I remember there being some confusion for me about somehow the degeneracy of the eigenspaces not matching up in the proper way. And this was something that concerned me mathematically about the general possibility of doing this relational versus global sort of internal tensor product decomposition. But maybe I'm wrong and it can be done in general, but it didn't look like it to me.
I'm not sure what you mean by degeneracy, but it's definitely the case that if I say start with a qubit and then encode its quantum states into the relational freedom of a qubit and some spin J system, then in general, the relational freedom will be a collection of two-dimensional virtual subsystems.
Yeah.
A whole bunch of them, some of which contain perfect copies of the thing I started with, and some of which are just garbage. So it is a sort of more complicated matrix algebra, like you map from just a simple quantum two-dimensional algebra to a direct sum of some two-dimensional algebras and some one-dimensional algebras. So in that sense, it's not what you would have intuitively expected. But I do think that it's delivering the right answer. That is what the relational degrees critical look like.
Okay. Yeah, and the only.
Is that what you meant by degeneracy? That you have all these copies of your original?
Yeah, but they don't all have the. So if one has the infinite dimensional case, I'm just trying to remember, but one has then, say, two number operators on each factor, say, bounded from below by zero. And one wants to, okay, so one takes a tensor product of these two, and then one wants to look for the relational information. So what do you have? You have the sum and the difference, or I can't remember exactly how it worked, this new tensor product structure, but
in that case it's
Yeah, okay, I need to refresh my memory of what happened in that case. And then the only other thing that I think of is that in this ball against the wall example, somehow when you have the wall completely external, that's the exact scenario in which momentum conservation is violated. So when one's talking about symmetry, that limit is slightly. How should I think about that?
Well, I think of it this way: when you treat the wall as an external potential, spatial translation symmetry has been violated.
Yeah.
The place where the potential goes up is a special place in space, and therefore you have no reason to expect momentum conservation to hold because you don't have spatial translation. It's only when you treat the wall dynamically that now you do recover spatial translation symmetry, and you recover momentum conservation, because when you bounce the ball off the wall recoils
exactly.
And it takes up momentum.
So I would agree, which then leads to a confusion in the sort of Aharonov-Susskind get out of the superselection rule scenario, because that looks to me like exactly the wall becoming infinitely heavy situation when they produce coherent superpositions of, what is it they do? It's a
charge
eigenstates, or atoms and molecules in the more recent, the Dowling and
But why is that a problem? Sorry, I didn't quite get what the problem with those approaches were.
Well, the fact that it sort of also breaks the symmetry in the same way that the wall being infinitely massive breaks the symmetry. What do you think?
I don't think it's the wall being infinitely massive that breaks the symmetry. That if I treat the wall that I have with degree of freedom, then you know whatever mass it has, I can preserve spatial translation symmetry. And the amount of momentum recoil on the wall will depend on its mass, and the velocity imparted on it will. Better say that the velocity will become less and less as the mass goes up. But so what? It's rather, I would say, when you decide to treat the wall, strictly speaking, as external, it doesn't get a Hilbert space. It doesn't get a coordinate. It's just, its effect is incorporated as an external potential that the particle sees.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
When you do that, you're explicitly saying the Hamiltonian now has a potential term in it, not just a kinetic term. And that potential term is not spatially translation symmetric. And so, another theorem doesn't hold. I don't have momentum conservation. It's a perfectly valid way of modeling the situation in the approximation that the wall doesn't recoil much. So I feel like it's so if I go over to the case where it's treated internally, no matter what mass I assign to it, I always have the conservation walls holding.
So I think what I meant was, treating it as actually infinite in the sense that it doesn't recoil, so there is zero effect. So I guess external potential in your description. Because then one, it's exactly what you say. One has a sort of effective Hamiltonian that is now not translation invariant.
It's a good question. I've never thought about whether it's enough to just take an infinite mass limit to get to external potential. I feel like it's not, because I'm still assigning it a coordinate, right? I say this thing has infinite mass, but it's still got a coordinate, so it still doesn't feel like I'm treating it as an external potential. And I imagine that it could still take up the momentum difference, even though its mass is infinite.
Where you take the limit, constant.
The mass becomes infinitely high, the velocity change becomes infinitely low, but their product stays exactly the delta p that it needs to be to compensate for the momentum. That's what you mean, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think one needs to do it. I mean, in this case, maybe the limit exists, but for example, the high amplitude limit of a coherent state is not a Hilbert space vector. So, yeah, one needs to do it rigorously.
Thanks for your talk. Can we thank Neil again then?
I didn't realize it was 5 o'clock already.